Act 3. 84. Exterior. The lighthouse. Night. The tide, now on the ebb, sends up explosions of foamy water, but the searchlight continues to swing around. Some of the windows at the top are broken out, but the lighthouse has won out over the storm. For now, anyway. 85. Exterior. The display window of the island drugstore. Night. The aisles of the store are filling up with snow, and it's started to coat the glass over the face of the pendulum clock, but we can still read the time. 8:47. 86. Interior. A corner of the town hall basement with Molly. She's in a wing chair in one corner with a pair of Walkman earphones on. They're on crooked and slipping down further all the time. We can hear the faint sound of classical music. Molly is fast asleep. Hands reach into the frame and take off the headphones. When this happens, Molly opens her eyes. There's a girl of about 17 standing beside her. Annie smiles, a bit embarrassed, and holds out the headphones. Annie Houston.
Want them back? They were, like, slipping off.
Molly.
No thanks, Annie. With those things, I always end up asleep and listening to Schubert on my fillings.
She gets up, stretches, then puts the Walkman on the seat of the chair. The part of the downstairs that serves as an activity area has been curtained off from the sleeping area, which we can see through the gap in the makeshift draw curtains. The kids are all sleeping now, and a few adults have turned in as well. There's a TV against one wall of the activity area. About 40 people are gathered around it, some sitting on the floor, some in folding wooden bingo chairs, some standing at the back. The TV is broadcasting a fuzzy picture that shows the weatherman from WVII, the Bangor ABC affiliate. Standing beside the TV and turning the rabbit ears this way and that, hoping for a better picture, pretty much a lost cause, I'm afraid, is Lucien Fournier, a good-looking man of about 30 in a reindeer sweater. He's one of Jack Carver's gay-bashing buddies. Weather guy. At this time, the storm is continuing to build, with the greatest concentrations of snow in the coastal and central areas. We here at Channel 7 find the numbers almost impossible to believe, but Machias is already reporting a fresh foot and a half. This is without the drift factor, remember, and zero visibility. No traffic is on the roads. Laugh. Hey, what roads, right? Conditions in Bangor are nearly as bad, with power outages reported all up and down the grid. Brewer is entirely dark, and in Southwest Harbor, a church steeple has reportedly blown over. It's bad out there, and we haven't seen the peak of the storm yet. This is one you'll be telling your grandchildren about, and they probably won't believe you. Every now and then, I have to look out the newsroom window to believe it myself. Standing near the back of the crowd, peering around the other standees, is Ursula Godso. Molly taps her on the shoulder, and Ursula turns to her, unsmiling. Molly nods toward the TV.
What are they saying?
Ursula.
Howl and blast, followed by blast and howl. Such condition to continue through tomorrow and into tomorrow night, when things are finally supposed to start quieting down. Power's out from Kittery to Millinocket. Coastal communities are cut off. Us island guys? Forget it.
She looks really dreadful. Molly sees it. She reacts with sympathy and some curiosity as well. Molly.
What's wrong?
Ursula.
I don't know. I've just got a feeling. A really bad one.
Molly.
Well, who wouldn't? Martha Clarendon murdered. Lloyd Wishman kills himself. The storm of the century right over our heads. Who wouldn't?
Ursula.
I think it's more than that.
87. Exterior. Angle on the supply shed. Night. For a moment or two, the doorway is empty, and then Kat steps slowly into it and stops. Her eyes are wide and blank. On the strip of visible skin between the top of her scarf and the bottom of her hat, we can see small stipples of blood on her cheeks. They look almost like freckles. In one hand, she still holds the cane. The wolf's head is once more caked with blood. The camera begins to move in as some comprehension of what she's done flickers in Kat's eyes. She looks down at the cane and drops it. 88. Exterior, the cane, from Cat's point of view. It lies just outside the doorway in the snow, leering up at her. The silver wolf's eyes are full of blood. 89. Exterior, resume Cat in the supply shed doorway. Night. She raises her gloved hands to her cheeks. Then, perhaps feeling something, she takes them away and looks at them. Her face is still blank, drugged-looking. She's in a state of shock. 90. Interior, the basement, features Molly and Ursula. Ursula looks around to see if they're being overheard. They're not, but she leads Molly toward a relatively deserted area near the foot of the stairs anyway, just to be safe. Molly looks at her, concerned and worried. Outside, the wind howls big. The women, on the other hand, are very small. Ursula.
When I get these feelings, I trust them. Over the years, I've learned to trust them. Molly, I think something's happened to Peter.
Molly, instant concern.
Why? Has anyone come back from the store? Has Mike?
Ursula.
No one's come in from that end of town since 8 o'clock, but Mike's okay.
She sees Molly isn't convinced and smiles a little bitterly. Ursula.
Nothing psychic about that part of it. I've picked up a couple of broken transmissions on the radio. Once it was Hatch. Once I'm pretty sure it was Mike.
Molly.
Saying what? Talking to who?
Ursula.
With the antennas blown down, it's impossible to tell, base unit to base unit. It's just voices. I imagine they're still trying to raise the Stades in Machias.
Molly.
So you haven't heard anything about Peter, and you can't know?
Ursula.
No, but somehow I do. If I can get Lucien Fournier to stop fiddling with that TV and take me down to the constables on a snow machine, can you mind things here?
Unless the roof falls in, all it amounts to is saying everything's fine, breakfast's at 7, and we still need folks on the serving crew and to do cleanup after. Work's mostly done for tonight, thank God. People have already started going to bed.
Molly. I'll come with you. Tavia can handle things here. I want to see Mike.
Ursula.
No, not with Ralphie here and a maybe dangerous prisoner down there.
Molly.
You've got a kid to think about, too. Sally's here.
Ursula.
It's Sally's dad I'm worried about, not Ralphie's. As for Tavia Godso, I'd never say this to her face because I love her, but she's got old maid's disease. She worships her brother. If she gets the idea anything happened to Peter.
Molly.
All right. But you tell Mike I want him to set a guard, however many men he needs. None of them's doing anything else tonight anyway. And get back here. Tell him his wife wants to see him.
Ursula.
I'll give him the message.
She leaves Molly and makes her way through the crowd around the TV, aiming for Lucien.
91. Exterior. Angle on the supply shed. Night. Cat is still looking at her hands, but now a kind of comprehension is starting to dawn in her eyes. She looks from the bloody cane to her bloody gloves. Back to the cane. Back to the gloves. Up into the storm. Then she opens her mouth as wide as it can go and shrieks. 92. Interior. The town hall kitchen. Night. Joanna, who is washing pots in the sink and happens to be closest to the back door, looks up, frowning. The others continue on with their work. Joanna.
Did you hear something?
Cora.
Just the wind.
Joanna.
It sounded like a scream.
Cora. Exaggerated patience.
That's how the wind sounds tonight, dear.
Joanna, who is just about set up with her mother-in-law, looks at Mrs. Kingsbury. Joanna.
Did that girl from the market come back in?
She didn't, did she?
Mrs. Kingsbury.
No, not this way.
Cora.
I imagine they had things to discuss, Joanna.
A sly look. Accompanying it, probably the dirtiest gesture we can get away with on network TV, or maybe it's too dirty. The old lady makes a loose fist, then taps the forefinger of her other hand around the edge of the hole, smiling as she does so. Joanna looks at this with distaste, then grabs a parka from the coat tree in the corner. It's too big, but she zips it up.
Cora, My mother always said, peep not at a keyhole, lest ye be vexed.
Joanna.
It sounded like a scream.
Cora.
I find that ridiculous.
Joanna.
Shut up, mother.
Cora is stunned. Mrs. Kingsbury is surprised, but also pleased, clearly restraining an impulse to yell, you go, girl. Joanna, who knows a good exit line when she says one, flips up the fur-lined hood of the parka and slips out the back door into the howling dark. 93. Interior. Resume town hall basement with Molly. She watches Ursula speak to Lucien, who stops twiddling the rabbit ears and listens intently. On the snowy TV screen, we see a map of Maine. Most has been colored in red with the words snow emergency displayed in big white letters. Also, 3 to 5 feet plus drifting, blowing snow. During this, weather guy. If you are in an outlying area, you are advised to stay where you are even if you have lost power and have no heat. Tonight, shelter is your prime necessity. If you are in a sheltered place, do not leave it. Keep warm, bundle up, share your food, and share your strength. If there was ever a night for good neighbors, this is it. There is a state of snow emergency in central and coastal Maine tonight. Repeat, there is a state of snow emergency on the coast and in the central regions of the state. Johnny Harriman and Jonas Stanhope come downstairs bearing big trays of cake and cookies. Behind them comes Annie Houston, with her arms wrapped around the shiny steel belly of an industrial-sized coffee urn. Molly, still very worried, stands aside to let them pass. She's intently watching Ursula's conversation with Lucien.
Johnny. Everything all right, Molly Anderson?
Molly. Fine, just fine.
Jonas Stanhope.
This is going to be one to tell your grandchildren about.
Molly.
It already is.
94. Exterior, between the back of the town hall and the shed. Night. Here comes Joanna, struggling along. The parka she grabbed flaps around her like a sail, and the hood keeps flying back. At last, however, she approaches the supply shed. The door is still open, but Cat is no longer standing in it. Still, Joanna stops, perhaps 6 feet outside the door. Something is wrong here, and, like Ursula, she feels it. Joanna.
Katrina? Cat?
Nothing. She comes forward another 2 steps into the hard, flickery light thrown by the gas lamp. She looks down at 95. Exterior. The snow outside the door. From Joanna's point of view, night. Most of the evidence has either been blown away or covered over by the shrieking wind, but there is still some pinkish stain where Cat dropped Linoge's cane, although the cane itself is gone. And beyond it is a brighter stain on the shed's door sill where Cat stood. 96. Exterior. Resume. Joanna. Night. Joanna.
Cat?
She would like to go back now. It's scary out here in the blizzard, but she's come too far. She steps very slowly toward the shed door, holding the parka's hood pinched shut at the base of her throat like an old woman's shawl. 97. Interior. The shed doorway. Looking out. Night. Joanna comes to the doorway and stands, eyes slowly widening with horror. 98. Interior. The supply shed from Joanna's point of view. Night. There's blood everywhere. On the industrial-sized boxes of cereal and powdered milk, the bags of rice and flour and sugar, the large plastic bottles labeled cola, orange drink, and fruit punch. There's blood sizzling on the side of the lantern, blood on the wall calendar, and bloody glove prints on the bare boards and beams. This is a pretty utilitarian place. There's blood on the goods Billy piled onto the toboggan, too. We can see this stuff because the tarp is gone. 99. Interior. Resume Joanna in the shed doorway. Looks at 100. Interior. The corner of the supply shed from Joanna's point of view. Here's the tarp. It's been used to cover Billy's body, but his feet stick out. The camera pans across the back of the shed. Here, in the other corner, Cat Withers is crouched in a fetal position, her knees drawn up to her chest, and the fingers of one hand crammed into her mouth. She looks up at Joanna, the camera, with wide, dazed eyes. 101. Interior. Resume Joanna in the shed doorway. Joanna.
Cat, what happened?
102. Interior. Resume Cat crouched in the corner. Cat.
I covered him up. He wouldn't want people to see him the way he is now, so I covered him up.
Pause.
I covered him up because I loved him.
103. Interior. Resume Joanna in the shed doorway. Utter horror. 104. Interior. Resume Cat crouched in the corner. Cat.
I think it was the cane with the wolf's head that made me do it. I wouldn't touch it if I were you.
Looks around.
So much blood. I loved him. And now look. I went and I killed him.
Slowly, she puts her fingers back into her mouth. 105. Interior. Resume Joanna in the shed doorway. Joanna.
Oh, Cat. Oh, my God.
She turns and blunders away into the dark, headed back in the direction of the town hall. 106. Interior. Resume Cat, crouched in the corner. She's huddled, looking around with big eyes. Then she begins to sing in a lilting little girl's voice. The words are muffled by her fingers, but we can make them out. Cat sings.
I'm a little teapot, short and stout. Here is my handle. Here is my spout. You can pick me up and pour me out. I'm a little teapot, short and stout.
107. Exterior. Joanna. Night. She's struggling back toward the town hall. The hood of the parka has been flipped back by the wind once more, but this time she makes no effort to pull it back up. She stops, seeing 108. Exterior, the town hall parking lot from Joanna's point of view, night. Two figures are fighting their way through the snow toward a rank of snowmobiles near the side of the building. 109. Exterior, resume Joanna, night. Joanna.
Hey, help! Help!
110. Exterior. Resume parking lot. Night. The two figures keep on moving. They haven't heard Joanna over the howl of the wind. 111. Exterior. Resume Joanna. Night. She changes course, heading for the parking lot instead of the kitchen door, and tries to run. She throws one terrified glance back over her shoulder at the open door of the supply shed. 112. Exterior. The parking lot with Ursula and Lucien. They reach one of the snowmobiles. Lucien gets on the front. Ursula shouts to be heard.
Don't you dump me in a snowbank, Lucien Fournier.
Lucien. No, ma'am. Ursula studies him for a moment, as if to make sure he is telling the truth, then gets on the snowmobile. Lucien turns the key. The headlight and the rudimentary dashboard lights come on. He pushes the starter. The engine cranks, but does not immediately start. Ursula.
What's wrong?
Lucien.
Nothing. She's just being grumpy.
He yanks the choke and prepares to start again. Joanna.
Faint voice. Hey, help, help.
Ursula puts her hand over Lucien's before he can punch the starter, and now they both hear. They turn forward. 113. Exterior. Joanna, from Ursula and Lucien's point of view, night. She comes struggling and floundering through the drifts, reaching the parking lot, waving one hand like a drowning woman. She is snow-covered, has taken at least one tumble, I'd guess, and gasping for breath. 114. Exterior, an angle on the parking lot, night. Lucien gets off the snowmobile and makes his way to Joanna, just in time to catch her before she can fall again. He helps her back toward the snowmobile, and Ursula joins them, very concerned. Ursula.
Joe, what's wrong?
Joanna.
Billy. Dead. Back there.
Points.
Katrina Withers killed him.
Ursula.
Cat?
Joanna.
She's sitting in the corner. I think she tried to tell me she hit him with a cane. There's so much blood. When I left, I think she was singing.
Shocked and bewildered reactions from Ursula and Lucien. Ursula recovers a little more quickly. Ursula.
Are you really saying Cat Withers killed Billy Soames?
Joanna nods violently.
Are you sure, Joe? Are you sure he's dead?
Joanna, nodding.
She covered him with a tarp, but I'm sure. So much blood.
Lucien.
We better go back and look. Joanna, terror.
I'm not going back there. I'm not going anywhere near there. She's in the corner. If you'd seen her, the look on her face.
Ursula.
Lucien, can I drive this thing?
Lucien. If you take it slow, sure, I guess. But,
Ursula.
I'll take it slow, believe me. Joe and I are going to drive down street and talk to Mike Anderson, aren't we, Joe?
Joanna nods with pitiful eagerness and climbs on the back of Lucien's snow machine. She'll agree to go anywhere before she agrees to go back to the supply shed. Ursula, to Lucien.
Get a couple of guys. Go out to the supply shed and see what's what, okay? But don't broadcast it. And play it smart.
Lucien. What's going on here, Ursula? She goes to the snowmobile, gets on the front and thumbs the starter button. Now that the engine's been choked, it starts easily. She guns the throttle, then settles her gloved hands on the hand grip. Ursula.
I have no clue.
She drops the snowmobile in gear and drives away in a spume of snow with Joanna clinging to her.
Lucien stands and watches them go, a picture of bewilderment.
115. Exterior, the island market, night. It's now a little more than a drifted in shape in the blizzard. The few lights seem feeble and forlorn. 116. Exterior, the loading dock behind the store, night. The snowmobile on which Jack Carver and Kirk Freeman arrived is almost buried in snow. On the loading dock itself, we see a shape that is Peter Godso. His body has been wrapped in a blanket and then secured with rope. He looks like a corpse that's ready for burial at sea. 117. Interior. Minoge. Close. His face is wolfish, intent. The eyes are bright and interested. The camera draws slowly back through the bars. As our view of Minoge widens, we see he has resumed his favorite position. Back to the wall, heels on the edge of the cot, peering through his slightly spread knees. 118. Interior, the constable's office. Angle on the desk. Here are Mike, Hatch, Robbie, Henry Bright, Kirk Freeman, and Jack Carver. The latter five look at Minoge with a mixture of distrust and fear. Mike is looking at him with perplexity.
Kirk, I never seen anyone throw a fit like that in my life.
Henry, to Mike.
No ID of any kind?
Mike.
No ID, no wallet, no money, no keys, no clothing tags either, not even on his blue jeans. He's just here, and that's not all.
To Robbie.
Did he tell you anything? When you went into Martha's house, Robbie, did he tell you anything he had no business knowing?
Robbie is immediately nervous. He does not, as they say, want to go there, but... Minoge, voice.
You were with a whore in Boston when your mother died in Machias.
Mike.
Robbie.
119. Interior. Martha Clarendon's living room. Flashback. Minoge peeps roguishly around one wing of Martha's chair, his face streaked with Martha's blood. Minoge.
She's waiting for you in hell. And she's turned cannibal. Hell is repetition, Robbie. Isn't it? Born in sin, come on in. Catch.
Davy Hopewell's blood-stained basketball flies at the camera. 120. Interior, resume constable's office. Night. Robbie flinches as if the basketball were flying at his head. That's how strong the memory is.
Mike.
He did, didn't he?
Robbie. He said something about my mother. You don't need to know.
His eyes turn mistrustfully to Minoge, who sits watching. Minoge shouldn't be able to hear what they're saying. Their voices are low-pitched, and they're most of the way across the room. But Robbie thinks, almost knows, that he can. He knows something else as well. Minoge could tell the others what he told Robbie, that Robbie was rolling around with a prostitute when his mother died.
Hatch.
I don't think he's human.
He looks at Mike almost pleadingly. as if asking him to contradict this. But Mike doesn't. Mike. Neither do I. I don't know what he is. Jack. God help us all. 121. Interior. Manoge. Close up. Watching them with wide-eyed intensity while the storm howls outside. Fade to black. This ends Act 3.